From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At his sentencing hearing this morning, President Trump's one-time legal fixer, Michael Cohen, said he took full responsibility for his actions, but said it was blind loyalty to then-candidate Donald Trump that led him to cover up what Cohen called Trump's dirty deeds.
Cohen has been cooperating with special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison for crimes that include lying to Congress about his Russia contacts during the 2016 presidential campaign and arranging hush money at Trump's request during the campaign to two women who claim to have had affairs with Trump. Let's bring in our political strategist, John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello.
And Jamal Simmons, Democrat and host at Hill TV. Hi, Jamal.
Good day.
Good day. So, dirty deeds, the words of the day. Cohen hasn't told special counsel Robert Mueller everything that he knows about Trump, but we do know that because of the Cohen case, President Trump himself has for the first time been linked to a federal crime, campaign finance violations in the form of this hush money to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Jamal, start with you. What do you think this means for the president?
I think the president is in increasing legal jeopardy. It is clear that he tried to have a financial relationship with the Kremlin during the presidential campaign. He lied about that in public, and now it appears that his lawyer also was making illegal contributions, facilitating illegal contributions because of his relationships with porn stars and Playboy bunnies. So there are things that we know about the president already, and they're distasteful, and there are things that we're finding out that may be more than distasteful but also illegal.
And John Brabender, I mean, what do you think about this? I mean, there's so much going on here. You've got Michael Cohen, as Jamal just said, making these payments to women. President Trump's base doesn't seem to care about the fact that he had relationships with these women or at least paid them off, for bringing it up. But there was, as Jamal says, also Michael Cohen's revelations that he was attempting to facilitate the building of a Trump Tower in Moscow, reports that maybe there would be a penthouse given to Putin. And this was way, way into the campaign. Look, you know, maybe the president says he's not worried. Should Republicans be worried?
Well, let's take this, because that's two completely different elements. Let's take the latter one first. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely nothing illegal about the president dealing with business matters with other countries while running for president.
But that he lied about it. And that's not illegal either. That's unethical.
So what it really came down to was, do you believe the president that the conversation started before Iowa, or do you believe Michael Cohen, somebody who has just pleaded guilty to lying to Congress, that it happened after Iowa?
I think the president already acknowledged that Michael Cohen was telling the truth. He says it doesn't matter. The president says it doesn't matter.
The reason that the president said it doesn't matter is that there's a disagreement on when the time was, but it doesn't matter because there was nothing inappropriate or illegal about it. And frankly, I don't think that's where the average voter is right now, saying, oh my gosh, was he talking to Russia before Iowa? Or maybe it really was after Iowa. It wasn't while he was president of the United States. So there's nothing wrong with that. The second thing is, now we have Cohen going to jail for a little under, I think, 3 years. And what people have to understand is the president, first of all, called for him to get the maximum sentence. Number two is, all of us have hired an attorney from time to time. And why do we hire them? To give us sound legal advice, because we assume they know more about the law than we do. Michael Cohen existed to give Donald Trump sound legal advice. If Michael Cohen did something that broke the law, he's the lawyer. He should have been the one to prevent that from happening. And so none of this, again, is under the Mueller Russia investigation. It's something that happened to Michael Cohen.
Jamal?
Well, the reality is that President Trump hired Michael Cohen to be his political fixer. Michael Cohen tried to fix his political problems, and he violated the law in doing so. And it appears that he did so at the direction of the president, which would make him an unindicted co-conspirator. At the same time that John just brings up this idea of him trying to have a business relationship in Russia, well, there is nothing wrong with having a business relationship in Russia, except if you're offering the president of Russia a $50 million penthouse, which could violate the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which we now know from Rex Tillerson, the president also wanted to get rid of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I wonder why.
Well, what did he call Rex Tillerson?
But
dumb as a rock, or what was Trump's nickname? I can't even remember. It was last week.
Who even knows?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the amazing moment that we saw yesterday in the Oval Office and the potential for a partial government shutdown next week. The Republican senator from Louisiana, John Kennedy, was on CNN this morning talking about this. And this comes down to border wall funding and government funding. President Trump and the Democratic leader, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer, they were in the Oval Office. Trump said he'd be proud to shut down the government over border security. Here's John Kennedy.
I don't think President Trump is bluffing, and I don't think Speaker Pelosi is going to give an inch because she wants to be Speaker. And if I've learned anything up here, I hate to say it, but most people in Washington care about their jobs first.
John, what do you think is going to happen? And are you worried that Republicans, after President Trump said he'd be proud of a shutdown, are going to pay a price if there is a shutdown?
Well, actually, I think he gave them some cover. It's interesting. Even as a Republican consultant, I often scratch my head at the way the president proceeds on messaging. In this case, I actually think it was quite ingenious. What he has done is, first of all, purposely taken ownership and say, this is not about the Republicans in the House or Senate or the Democrats in the House. I'm going to own this because I'm going to define it as securing our border, which secures American families. And I'm willing to take that fight onto me. And if they want to fight me on that, they're the one who's going to lose. I'm going to own this because the American people want to feel secure. Second of all, the president's made it clear that he's willing to compromise. In fact, if you remember, the first request he had was for about $23 million for the wall. He's down to $5 million. The Democrats are willing to do $1.6 million. Why they won't do this, I don't understand who they're trying to protect other than Nancy Pelosi trying to play to the extreme left, new socialist part of the Democrat Party that she needs to remain in the position she's in.
Well, I guess a lot of Republican congressmen on the border where the wall would be, they don't think it will work. I mean, that's their point. But Jamal, to the point that they seem to, you know, many analysts are saying, and John doesn't seem to agree, but they seem to have been able to box the president into claiming a shutdown. And you can ask Newt Gingrich how people feel about the people behind shutdowns. How do you feel about that moment? We hear you, John, that you think that that was ingenious. But Jamal, your thoughts?
Republicans continuously are blamed for shutdowns because people basically think that Republicans aren't in favor of the government. So nobody ever really thinks Democrats want to shut down the government. But now we have a Republican president who said, "If I don't get my way, I am happy to shut down the government. If I don't get my way," who talks like that in adult life? If I don't get my way, I'm going to throw a temper tantrum. I think this is a big problem. And frankly, also we talked about Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, hashtag boss. She was in that meeting and she ruled the day over the president.
Yeah, well, let's not forget, Nancy Pelosi first was the one that said, oh my gosh, we have to turn off the cameras, when the president said, let's have a little transparency so the American people can see what this really is. Second of all, the thought that Democrats never have shutdowns, if that's the case, why did we have the quote-unquote Schumer shutdown not that long ago? And
your
number
quote.
Three, what the president has done is said, here's what this shutdown is about. It's about protecting American people. Either you're for it or you're against it. I think that's the most important part of government. And I'm going to go to whatever lengths I have to protect the American people. And I think that branding actually works to his defense.
Okay. Well, as almost Speaker Pelosi did say yesterday, if the president wants to pass a border protection bill, a wall bill, he could do it today. Pass it in the House, pass it in the Senate, sign it in the White House.
But you know,
Republicans control the entire government.
He needs 10 more votes from the Democrats in the Senate that aren't there.
Which is what he was saying yesterday. We have to get to the most important part of what happened yesterday in the Oval Office, and that's Mike Pence, the vice president. Here's Seth Meyers on NBC. The comedians just had a field day with this.
Also, what is Mike Pence doing? I guess when Schumer said shutdown, Pence took him literally.
John, you worked for Pence. Don't you think it was a little weird that he just sat there the whole time while they were talking?
Well, look, what Mike Pence does is he offers a lot of important counsel to the president before meetings and after meetings. And I think it was important for the president to show that he personally was going to own a potential shutdown. I think that was the strategy going into there. And I think that that's what certainly came out of it.
Well, look, I have to say, I'm in somewhat defense of Vice President Pence. Who would want to jump into that sandbox? That was kind of such a mess. So maybe he maintained a little dignity. Very quick. The Senate yesterday confirmed the second of President Trump's judicial nominees to have been confirmed despite being rated unqualified by the American Bar Association. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says reshaping the judiciary is the GOP's most significant contribution to the country. Many people said, why was Jeff Sessions jettisoned when he actually, you know, helped do this? Jamal, I would take it you'd see it differently. These are unqualified, according to the American Bar Association.
I think we ought to have some general bar of, no pun, some bar of acceptability around judges. It appears the president is willing to appoint people who are not especially qualified. But we've seen that not only there, we've seen that at the EPA and at other places where the president has tried to appoint people who really can't do the job.
Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, and John Brabender, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
British Prime Minister Theresa May is fighting for her job. She spoke in the House of Commons ahead of a no-confidence vote today over her plan for Brexit.
The public voted to leave the EU. They want us to secure a deal that delivers on that result. And we shouldn't risk handing control of the Brexit negotiations to opposition MPs in Parliament, because that would mean risking delaying Brexit or even stopping Brexit.
Joining us now is David Lammy, a member of Parliament from the opposition Labour Party. David Lammy, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, great to be with you.
And let's just be clear before we get into this conversation about your point of view. You, if you had your druthers, you would just not Brexit at all, right?
I've always believed that the best place for the United Kingdom to be is within the European Union. I recognize that there have been concerns about the sovereignty of the UK and some of the bureaucracy of the European Union, but ultimately, I, like many Brits, and certainly the 48% that voted Remain, believe that whilst there are issues with the European Union, Britain is better off with a seat at the table, leading from the front and trying to reform the European Union, not outside it.
So what should happen now? Should Prime Minister May keep her job and keep trying to work out a deal, or should she go?
Well, we're certainly at a moment of national crisis in the UK that I've never seen in our history. We're now in a situation where the crisis is within the Conservative political party. We will see in the next few hours whether Theresa May keeps her job. My sense is that she will, in fact, remain as leader of the Conservative Party, having spoken to several Conservative MPs over the last few hours, but she will be incredibly weakened. She still has to get her deal through Parliament in the coming weeks. I suspect that she will still not be able to get her deal through Parliament. So ultimately, in our system, when politics is stuck, the order of the day is you hand the issue back to the people, either in the form of a general election or, in this case, a referendum on the issue of staying in the European Union or accepting Theresa May's deal.
So you think there should be, or there will be, a second referendum on Brexit?
Well, the difficulty is when there was this referendum campaign, a whole load of things were said by those that wanted to leave the European Union, most of which could never be delivered, and certainly not delivered without considerable pain. So there is no configuration of a deal that can easily get through the UK Parliament. And just to explain this to an American audience, if you want to leave with a hard Brexit, just a sort of trade deal and nothing else with the European Union, similar to the sort of trade deal that Canada has with the European Union,
right,
then you're going to create a hard border in Northern Ireland and go back to the bad old days in Northern Ireland. And you're going to have quite a lot of turbulence in our trade at the moment within the single market is frictionless. So there are lots of parliamentarians that won't accept that. If you go for a softer Brexit, something more like the relationship that Norway has with the European Union, then you're into a situation where free movement more or less continues across Europe, and that was a big issue for those who wanted to leave in terms of immigration. And quite a lot of people will not accept that. So the problem here is this is a curate's egg. It's very hard to get a Brexit that can command a majority in the House of Commons and hasn't got enemies. And for all of those reasons, I think ultimately this will have to be settled by the British public in a second referendum where they can instruct politicians, this is what we want you to do, and I hope that that instruction is to remain within the European Union.
But we were just in the UK, and we did several broadcasts about Brexit, and I spoke to people around the country who said they would feel betrayed if there were a second referendum because the first referendum was not billed as best of three. That was it, and that's what people wanted.
I honestly think that when we had the referendum, quite a lot of British people will tell you they weren't sure what they were voting for. The average member of the British public, and similarly to the average member of the American British public, does not know the detail of a trade issue. Nevertheless, we've now had, for the last 2.5 years, a very heated debate, a debate that it would have been nice if we'd had for the last 30 years about our relationship with Europe. I think the British public are more informed, but more importantly, they can vote on something that's in front of them. You've got Theresa May's deal and all that's been said about it, and you have what you know already, which is our relationship with the European Union within the European Union. Those are tangible things that the British public can choose to go for or not. And that's why I think that that this people's vote, as we're calling it, this second referendum, is very different to the last.
But why isn't your leader, Jeremy Corbyn, saying what you're saying, that there should be a second referendum?
Well, it's true to say that there are splits in both parties, and there have been historically splits in the Labour Party. You know, some of the seats in the industrial north of Britain voted leave. These are areas of the country that haven't seen a pickup after the 2008 crash, areas that have not recovered from some of the changes that were made under Margaret Thatcher, areas that have struggled in the last 8 years with austerity. Now, my view is that for those areas of the country, don't blame the European Union, which was actually sometimes delivering funds to those areas to ease the pain. Blame domestic politics that is responsible for that. And that's why we're now seeing Northern MPs in the northeast of the country, up by places like Newcastle, Darlington, Hartlepool, also talking about having a people's vote in the second referendum, because they're listening to manufacturers, they're listening to big employers, some of the car manufacturers and others, who are saying, look, I'm afraid we're going to pull out if Britain goes forward with this.
I just want to ask you one more thing. Your speech in the House of Commons the other day went viral. And here's one of the things that you said in that speech. Let's listen.
At its worst, the British Empire was exploitation and subjugation, moral superiority that led to putting humans in shackles, the oppression of black and brown people because this country thought it knew best. Those countries once coloured pink on the globe were not won in negotiations. They were taken by force. Today, we need to build a new image of Britain, one that brings this country together after years of division.
Now, one of the things that our listeners cannot see is that you yourself are black, and you made that comparison between what you're seeing right now with Brexit and the colonial past of Britain. What do you think is the connection there between the two?
There are two aspects to this point. The first is it's absolutely clear that people like Nigel Farage, who led the UKIP party and has in part been responsible for this decision to Brexit, want to recreate something they call Empire 2.0. It is an idea that harks back to Britain's colonial past, in which they seem to have forgotten that Britain took those countries that were pink on the map by force, not by negotiation. And during that period, some terrible things were done that involved slavery and enslaved people and involved the subjugation of lots of colonial people across the globe. And indeed, there are countries like the United States that fought off the Brits and said, no, thank you, we want to go our own way.
Right.
So it's a conceit to give the idea that somehow Britain can recreate this, because Britain surely can't recreate this. When you go to negotiate with the Indians, they will remind you of that sorry period in which their country was being run from London. I think the second point to this is that Britain sometimes tells itself a story that is a story of winning the Second World War, almost as if we sort of stood alone in the darkest hour. That is not, in fact, right. The Americans helped us considerably and bankrolled us, actually, for years after the Second World War, and lots of Commonwealth soldiers from places like India, the Caribbean, but also New Zealand, Australia, Canada, assisted us in that Second World War enterprise. So we were never a sovereign state doing it entirely on our own. It was always through key alliances and key diplomacy. Well, that is what the European Union is. That is why what it was forged. It was forged in part to keep peace in the continent of Europe. And of course, as we watch around the world, as right-wing forces dominate across the world and hard-right forces dominate, it is very, very worrying that this energy of populism loses that hope of peace that forged the European Union. The European Union is imperfect. Like any democracy, it's imperfect, and there are ways in which it does need reform. But my God, let us not forget that it was forged out of the seat of terrible conflict, two conflicts in the 20th century that cost millions of lives, American lives, British lives, and lives across the globe. And I worry a lot that some in the United Kingdom have lost sight of that wonderful, audacious vision, as imperfect as it was.
That is David Lammy, a member of the British Parliament in the opposition Labour Party. Mr. Lammy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can watch the full video of David Lammy's speech in the House of Commons, the one that went viral. It's at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did you ever think of your mailbox as a money-making opportunity? Well, the Trump administration thinks it is, maybe a way to rescue the U.S. Postal Service from billions of dollars of debt. The White House is proposing that the USPS sell access to your mailbox to private companies such as FedEx and UPS. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this would be a big change to a 1934 restriction that says only Postal Service mail carriers can deliver to a mailbox, which means, by the way, even slipping a card into your neighbor's mailbox is illegal. Is that for real?
Believe it or not, it is. As you said, in 1934, a law was passed putting, quote unquote, any mailable matter into a mailbox is illegal unless you're a postal service worker. And, you know, there have been efforts in the past to do away with it. For example, I found a very lengthy 1997 report from the General Accounting Office to the House of Representatives discussing the pros and cons of this restriction and whether or not they should loosen it. But as of today, it still stands. I'm not sure how often it is actually prosecuted, but technically, yes, it's illegal to drop a card in your neighbor's mailbox.
Which is why FedEx and UPS, if they're delivering something to you, they just put it on your doorstep.
That's exactly right. And so the appeal to them would be, should they be able to legally gain access to people's mailboxes? Say, for example, in the suburbs, they would no longer have to stop their truck and park it and walk up the driveway to put it on someone's front porch, they could just drop smaller packages into the mailbox. And that kind of shows you what the post office is thinking as far as, why these companies would be willing to pay for access to mailboxes.
And these companies would just pay the U.S. Postal Service?
Yeah, that's the idea, according to the Wall Street Journal, which had a story out on it yesterday. It's unclear exactly what the terms would be. I'm sure there'd be a negotiating process, but that's the general idea.
It gets us to the bigger question of why the Postal Service, which lost nearly $4 billion last year, why is it losing so much money, given that everything that people are buying right now is being shipped?
Right. Well, there's a couple main reasons. One of them being people just don't mail as many letters and cards as they used to because of, email and electronic communications. But also the Postal Service is saddled with very significant costs for pensions and other retirement benefits. And that's probably the main reason why they struggle. And again, remember, the Postal Service was designed to be a government service, not exactly a profit center. So that's part of it, too.
So what do you think is going to happen? Is this Trump administration idea to sell access to people's mailboxes going to go anywhere?
I think it's certainly something that they should study. The argument against it, obviously, is the Postal Union views it as almost a privatization of the Postal Service. So I think there will be some debate and study, but it's important to point out that the Postal Service already does partner with FedEx and UPS and other commercial delivery companies for what they call that last mile access. I doubt that these companies will find it very attractive to sort of take over that bread and butter mail delivery of cards and bills and that sort of thing.
Well, one thing is for sure, Mike, and that is that we are all criminals, because I'm sure that we have all put a piece of mail into somebody's mailbox before.
Yeah, I know I'm guilty.
Part of the Postal Service. Mike Regan at Bloomberg, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, where we live in fear of the grammar police, listeners who are on that keyboard at the first sign of a mix-up between less and fewer, or between and among, and don't get them started on subject-verb agreement errors. Well, now there is a new cop on the beat. Actually, Ellen Jovin is more the Ann Landers of grammar, with a grammar table she's been setting up on Manhattan's Upper West Side. She's at the NPR studios in New York. Ellen, how did this start?
Well, I was sitting in my apartment this summer and feeling that it was too hot to do anything fun outside. So while I was sitting there, I thought it would be a good idea to have a table and answer grammar questions. So I ordered a table and then designed a sign, and then I waited for it to get cooler. That's really about it. It just seemed like a good idea.
Yes, and others are noting it. And by the way, what does your sign say?
My sign says a lot of things. It says grammar table, but then I also drew the sign on an iPad, and I also added ideas for things people could talk about. So for instance, it says comma crisis, semicolon phobia for people who are afraid of semicolons. Sometimes people who don't know what they're supposed to talk about at a grammar table, not that there's a prescription for it, but it maybe gives them ideas about what they could bring up.
Well, we love this. We were reading about it in the New York Times, which saw your table. And apparently you're running across people that we run across as well, people who are obsessed with this. People, right? They're doing their own grammar editing. Tell us about some of the people you've met.
The Upper West Side is just full of people who are just complete word nuts or word nerds. They love grammar. They love language. So there are lots of people who come up to the table who are really quite sophisticated about language. And they just they're happy to have, someone else caring about it and maybe making some public display of that interest so we could have a little language community.
So there was one woman you met who, there's the word copyright, but her Instagram account is copy wronged. And what she's been doing is tracking errors in restaurant menus, which she's finding a lot. But do people also debate you? Do they come to trip you up?
Of course they do. And usually the people who come to trip me up are male. I have
the mansplaining you about grammar.
Well, it has happened. I mean, I really try not to use that word, but I get quizzed more by guys. Let's see, over the weekend, someone came up to me and said, "What's an appositive?" That's appositive. And so I started to answer, and I paused, and I said, "Do you really want to know the answer to this, or are you just seeing if I know?" And he said, "Just seeing if you know." So they usually admit it. I mean, some other guy came by a few weeks ago and said, "What's the difference between a restrictive relative clause and a non-restrictive relative clause?" Same thing. That makes me suspicious.
Ellen, what's an appositive?
An appositive is, for example, if I said, "My neighbor, comma, a carpenter, comma, makes a lot of noise." The carpenter is an appositive. It renames the neighbor.
Aha.
A noun phrase or a noun that is a renaming of one usually before it. And then often you have to decide if it needs commas or not. So that's a whole other thing.
And what about that other one?
Okay. So a relative clause is a group of words containing a subject and a verb. And it begins with words like that, which, who. And sometimes it limits the noun in front of it, and sometimes it just describes it without limiting. For example, I threw away the books that were dusty.
Uh-huh.
That clause, "that were dusty," is limiting. That's a restrictive relative clause. You didn't throw away all the books. You kept the non-dusty ones. I mean, the same person would just dust all the books, but whatever. That's but I threw away the books, comma, which were dusty. You threw away all the books, and oh, by the way, they just happened to be dusty. That's a non-restrictive relative clause.
Okay, let's review. A restrictive relative clause restricts the description to one thing. So I threw away the books which or that were dusty, just the dusty books. At a comma, you've got a non-restrictive clause. I threw away the books, comma, which were dusty. All of them were, not restricted to just some. Wow. That just was so fresh, what you just did. So, okay, people challenge you, but are there people who are genuinely, you know, sidling up to you like, you know, "I never knew this. What is this?"
I get a lot of sincere questions. People come up and sometimes they won't even say hello. I find it so odd. They just walk up. I think it's funny. I love it. But they just walk up and they'll say, "Is there an apostrophe in this word?" As though it's perfectly normal to see a grammar table, like there's a grammar table on every block. And so they just happen to stop at this one and ask a question. And I also get a ton of questions from people who have been perplexed by something for ages and didn't know how to look it up. They often concern commas, apostrophes, odd plural forms, maybe the past participle of an irregular verb. For instance, the verb to eat. The past tense of that is just ate. I ate. But then you have another form. I have eaten. That word eaten that comes after the form of to have is the past participle. And a lot of times people aren't sure what the correct form is to use. You hear people say, "I should have went," mm-hmm. sometimes. Mm-hmm. So they're using the past tense form went rather than "I should have gone." Mm-hmm. None of these are tragedies. I mean, I'm not there to make people feel bad. I'm not there to be pedantic. I really want to engage people in a conversation about language and also to learn from them because people speak, there are 800 languages in New York City. So I figure there's a lot of language stuff I can learn from them.
Yeah. And in your day job, you and your husband have a communication skills training company. You do this with, you know, governments and companies and you help people better communicate. So this is your thing. But you don't have to go out there. You don't make any money off of it. Why do you do this?
I just really, really love language. And until September, I was spending so much time posting language thoughts online. I have a whole global network of language nerds who love to talk about language with one another. And so I post things. When I come across something interesting, I post it, and then we talk about it online. But too much computer time makes you weird. And I thought, I can do the same thing on the streets of New York, and that's what I did.
Wow. And when you say, you know, it's not tragic if somebody doesn't have the right grammar, but it's important. I'm reading about a young girl from El Salvador. She's working on a college application essay, you know, kind of hovering around you, and you ended up helping her write it.
Well, it's interesting because she wanted to know the difference between passive and active voice. That was her primary question. I tried to explain it to her, and then I realized, okay, we really need to have the essay because sometimes students don't report with 100% accuracy what's really being told to them about their writing weaknesses. So I wanted to see. And when she brought it, in fact, there was very little content. So I ended up talking to her about how to generate more content, what would be interesting about her life, and what she needed to understand that I didn't know about her so she could explain it in more details.
Biggest mistake people make with grammar?
I don't really think there is a biggest mistake. I think people sometimes think there is, and they end up with this little checklist of, you know, five things that decide whether you're an educated human being or not. A woman came over yesterday, and she was disturbed that so many people are combining the word none with plural verbs. So none were open. None of the stores were open. None were open. And so she thought it should always be singular. And I said, well, that's really not true. It can mean not one or not any. I bring about 8 different reference books with me to the table so that people don't just have to rely on me, a random stranger sitting there on the street. So I opened up one of the books to the entry on none. And, you know, she was reading it and she didn't look very happy that this was not actually an issue, but I don't like thinking of it that way. I don't like thinking of, oh, you don't know this thing and that marks you as uneducated. I think we all come from such different language backgrounds and experiences. So if someone pronounces often and you know, that's not how you think it should be pronounced, that doesn't mean that they don't have a million things to contribute to your intellectual life as well.
Well, and you sent her away presumably thinking, well, she insists that it has to be none of the stores was open, that no one will die if they say none of the stores were open.
That's right. There actually are no grammar police. There's no van. There are no men. No, there aren't. And I want this to be a friendly grammar table that people won't be. Sometimes people ask me questions from 10 feet away, like they're afraid I'm going to give them a quiz and then mark it with a red pen and send it to their boss or something.
A citation.
And I want it to be a friendly grammar table.
Well, we will send people your way. Ellen Jovin, look for her grammar table on the Upper West Side or Times Square around New York. Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me and Grammar Table on.
And listeners, are you ready? Because Ellen has generously offered to set up her friendly table at hereandnow.org just for a few hours today. Send your questions or comments. She will reply. The Grammar Helper is in. Go to hereandnow.org.
The Trump administration is asking the Supreme Court to allow it to enforce a ban on asylum for any migrants who cross the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. President Trump announced the policy last month in response to the migrant caravan that was approaching the border. 2 federal courts have temporarily blocked it, including the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco, which said last week that the ban is inconsistent with federal law and an attempted end run around Congress. Now, the caravan has been in the news a lot, but the people in it have their own stories, and we're going to hear one of them right now. Last year, a woman from El Salvador traveled in a migrant caravan to the Mexico-California border seeking asylum in the U.S., and this year, her teenage son has made the same journey with the current caravan. Farida Jablava Romero from Eversation KQED caught up with the boy's mom and the San Francisco Bay Area family that has taken her in.
Y tres.
Veronica Aguilar is helping to bake a cake in her host's gleaming kitchen near Berkeley.
There you go.
She dips a finger in the batter to have a taste.
Yo sí. Chocolate.
Not too long ago, Aguilar's life was very different. She was jailed at an immigration detention center for 7 months after she applied for asylum at the San Diego border. But in June, she got out of jail when Anne and Kent Moriarty sponsored her. The Moriartys were strangers, but now they feel like family, says Aguilar.
Siempre están allí cuando yo los necesito, si yo tengo.
They're always there when I need them, she says. Sitting at the kitchen table, Anne Moriarty says opening her home to Aguilar and another Salvadoran family seeking asylum felt like the right thing to do.
We're both Christians, and that's actually part of what has motivated us in thinking of how Christ talks about welcoming the stranger.
Kent says he sees that his house guests sometimes are treated with suspicion.
Yeah, I don't want him to see us in our country is full of mean people that don't welcome them.
Aguilar says she fled death threats from gangs in El Salvador. And she says the only way to keep her 15-year-old son from being recruited by gangs was for him to get out. So she asked her mom to travel with him more than 2,000 miles in the caravan to keep him safe. The next day, I make my way to Tijuana, just south of the California border, to meet Aguilar's son, Vladimir, and her mother, Lucy Diaz. Diaz was staying at a sports complex turned shelter with about 4,000 migrants. She walked so much, her feet got bloody, she says.
He caminado kilómetro tras kilómetro.
But she says her grandson couldn't stay in their town near San Salvador. It's a red zone for gangs.
Zona roja de pandillas.
But Vladimir is not here with her. Diaz decided he'd be safer at a small youth shelter across town, with regular meals and access to immigration attorneys.
Más seguro, porque ya está en manos de profesionales.
And here's the thing. After that whole journey, Lucy Diaz now has to tell her grandson goodbye. She's not going to cross the border with him.
Yo no puedo esperar a entregarlo a la frontera.
She's going back to El Salvador to take care of two other grandchildren who she's raising. But before she leaves, she needs to see her grandson one more time. At the youth shelter, a dozen teens sit on couches, watching soccer on TV. Diaz and her grandson go to a quiet room to talk. Vladimir says he's okay.
Pues aquí estoy bien, aquí no nos falta nada.
But his eyes are wide. He looks scared. This 15-year-old will have to try to cross the border, request asylum, and reach his mother in the Bay Area alone.
Sí, difícil porque no sé qué va a pasar.
It's hard. I don't know what's going to happen, if I'll be able to cross or not, he says. Grandma Lucy Diaz reaches over and hugs Vladimir close.
Yo lo amo mucho. Y que si me lo trae para acá, yo...
Remember, I love you, she says, crying. I brought you here not to abandon you, but to make sure you have a future. Take care, she says. It could be months before Vladimir gets to see a U.S. asylum officer. If he doesn't pass an initial screening, he'll be deported to El Salvador. Meanwhile, all Veronica Aguilar can do is watch and wait from far away. She says she's consumed with worry.
Solo tengo que tener paciencia, aunque
I have to be patient, she says. But as a parent, I just want to protect him. One thing that gives her comfort, she says, is that she's not alone.
A saber de que están ellos apoyándome.
She knows her sponsors, the Moriartys, are with her. They say they'll figure it out together, like family. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.